And now, talking with, what is your first name actually? I thought it was Chris.
It's Chris Christensen, but it's really Wilbert, but I hate that name so much that I don't
use it. So talking with Chris Christensen on 27 August 76 at Grenoble. Well, the first publication I have for you involved in radio astronomy is 49, but can you tell me about your background before then?
Yes, well, I think my first publication was actually on deuterium. It was in the determination of, started with a determination of the amount of deuterium in common water.
I see.
And during the course of it, this is when I was doing my master's degree, and during the course of it, I discovered that one could actually change the concentration by fractional distillation. This was with a very accurate relative density system we had. And the result was that this nearly became an industrial process when the atomic energy well, even perhaps before that, they were looking for heavy water, and it was seriously considered that an industry would be started in New Zealand using fractional distillation for the preparation of heavy water. So that was the first one. Then I'd intended to get a job as an astronomer, and I had a job lined up. This was, say, a few years after graduation.
Well, what year are we talking about now?
Perhaps we better go back. Yes, I graduated in, I went to the university in 1931. I did a three-year physics course. In those days, it was a three-year course of physics, the honours course. And then I got my master's degree in 1 year after that, and I think that I was the last to do that because they changed the regulations to make that illegal after that.
Uh-huh. And which university was it?
That was the University of Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of the department was old Professor Leiby, who is famous for the Kay and Leiby tables, which is physical tables, which is still in use. He was a fine old physicist of the old school, one of the Cambridge people. Well, then when I left the university, I intended, as I said, to get a job at Melbourne Observatory, and I had the job lined up, and someone tipped me off that they were going to close it down because of the depression.
I see.
So there was only one job available, and that was in a factory in Sydney, a radio factory. Well, my interest in radio was zero at that stage, but as it was the only job, I got a job in the research labs. And I was working with some of the people who were actually the pioneers in the ionosphere. There was Green, Builder and Baker, who were all quite well known in the early days of the ionosphere.
Now, were they doing ionospheric research?
No, they'd both all lost their jobs too, I think, and gone into this radio factory.
I see.
Anyway, it was a good place. At that time, we were. I would say by far the best industrial laboratory in Australia. It was called Amalgamated Wireless Australia.
Oh yes.
And since then it's just become, first of all, it lost its research and development, and now it's even lost its manufacturer. I think it's like a lot of these industries in Australia, it's now trading organisations putting together Japanese or Taiwanese stuff.
Right.
Well, what happened? Oh yes, so I worked there for a while, and a couple of years before the war started, and then it was fairly complicated, but the head of AWA was also the head of the manpower, so it was a real clamp on everyone, so we couldn't do anything, not only during the war, but for a couple of years afterwards while the manpower regulations were on.
I see.
I was put under the long distance communications working, it was on the Beam Wireless Service there, which was the main overseas one, but I was working with the American Army for quite a bit too on their establishing new communications in the Pacific.
I see.
And then during that period, I think I became very interested in antennas, and I produced quite a few papers, which are still referred to fairly extensively in the things like what is it, CCIR and so on antennas, it's still fine.
I'm not familiar with that. What's that?
Comité Consultatif International Radio or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the big international bodies. And so even still, some of my designs appear in that.
And when were they published?
That was published. They were published in a little journal that no one read, called the AWA Technical Review. But a lot of that was reprinted in textbooks and things. In fact, it's one of the few things in that journal I think ever did see the light of day. And this was on multiple rhombic antennas,
uh-huh.
And they were damn good. And they're still used in quite a few countries, and also a few other such devices. So I was very much interested in highly directive antennas.
So you didn't work actually in radar per se, but in communications?
No, it was in communications, yeah. And in highly directional antennas for communications. I guess
and
there's
what
still,
sort of frequencies?
The sort of 6 to 25 megahertz.
And in the course of the wartime work, did you become aware of Hayes' discovery that the sun gave off?
No, not that. But I had read that the original papers, of course, of
Jansky.
And I think I read, in fact, I'm sure I read a paper produced by Gret Reber.
That's right, 1940, he had one in Proceedings of the IRA.
That's right.
Right.
Yes, and I read that. So I was quite interested in it, and then when the war was over, I tried to escape from AWA, and I went to see Joe Causey, who mm-hmm. was, because I was interested in astronomy, and I thought this was it. And I'd also become, by that time, sort of the expert on antennas for AWA, so I felt I wasn't learning anything anymore. Mm-hmm. I was just being consulted all the time, and which I found very painful. So I went to Joe Causey, and he was quite interested in what I'd done while I was in the communications, and he offered me a job, but then when the thing came about, I didn't get the job because it turned out that AWA still had a wartime agreement with the Radio Physics Lab, which was a radar place
right.
in those days, in which the CSIRO had said they wouldn't take anyone from AWA that AWA wanted to keep, and they said they wanted to keep me. So I went back very annoyed to the AWA, and then a few months later, I went again and to see Causey, and I discovered that the agreement had now lapsed, so I was given a job there.
No, this is what year?
So then I got to CSIRO, and that's where I did the bulk of my radio astronomy work.
Right, but which year was this?
This was must have been 1947.
And so there was a two-year period before you were able to get away from AWA.
Yes, that's right.
Let me also ask, though, in the communications work during the war, did you ever hear of anyone alluding to background noise as a problem?
No, not a word. Mm. Not a word. Rather interesting, but except not as a problem, but purely as an interesting fact, of course, from the Jansky's.
Right.
So this is quite intriguing.
But it was of no practical consequence then.
No, I was actually looking for, wondering whether I could measure it in our own equipment, but none of our antennas were directed to any really hot part of the galaxy, so it didn't. I didn't ever pick up any noise.
Did you make efforts to?
Yes, I just for fun, just to see if when the thing went through the galaxy whether I could see an increase or.
I see.
But it didn't. I didn't pick up anything.
But
it wasn't a serious effort. It was
yeah.
just sort of playing around.
Right.
Because at that time I was interested in communications.
But what about communications is vital in terms of major solar flares and fade outs and
yes.
so forth. And
oh, I was interested in that, yes. Expected fade outs. Oh, definitely.
But in retrospect, one can go back and find that amateurs in the late 30s had noticed that the noise level in their sets went up when associated with fade outs.
That's right. Yes, they were right on the ball, and they got Appleton, they put Appleton onto this, so that's
yeah.
how Appleton got into the
right.
scheme at the beginning.
But there were, as far as you know, there were no professionals, so to speak, who made the deduction that the actual electromagnetic radiation was coming from the sun.
None that I know of.
Okay, so let me just go back also. Why did you want to become an astronomer after having been working in nuclear physics and so forth?
Well, when I was a child, I had an uncle who lived in the country, and him and I was very fond, and he was a complete cripple. He'd been crippled in childhood, and he had left school, I guess, at the age of 14, but he was a very, very learned fellow, and he was a crazy amateur astronomer.
I see.
And so he got me interested in this at a very early age.
So even though your training wasn't particularly there, you still wanted to,
yes, that's right,
to do that?
I'd been interested in astronomy since I was a very small child. Hmm.
So, coming to the CSIRO in 1947,
yes.
The first thing I did,
I was put in a group with a fellow called Don Yapsley,
mm-hmm.
with Fred Lahaney, who's now chief of the division of National Measurements Laboratory in Sydney. Have you met him?
No.
Chief of the division of, it was called the National Standards Lab.
I should try to talk to him when I come to Australia.
Yes, he was one of the really early ones. Well, Fred had beaten me from AWA by a year or so,
mm-hmm.
and or 2 years. He got out at the end of the war. And so it was Fred, actually, who had left, was about to leave radiophysics to become chief of the division of National Standards, that he tipped me off this job was going. Anyway, I took over from him with Don Yapsley on just routine measurements of the sun with an old radar antenna, and we're doing quite a bit of stuff on bursts and so on, very early. And then I read a paper of Arthur Covington's on his eclipse measurement.
Right, in 47,
yeah,
I think that was, right?
And so I thought to myself, I think we ought to, there was a partial eclipse coming up in Australia, and I thought to myself, well, now we could triangulate it. If I could get measurements done at two or three mm-hmm. different places simultaneously, we could actually, by triangulation, get the position of these things.
Right.
So I arranged an eclipse expedition in November.
It was November 48.
Yeah, that's right, November 48. And so we did this several of us. In fact, Bernard Mills.
Well, you told me about it a couple of days ago, right.
Bernard's first look at radio astronomy, that was, because he wasn't concerned with radio astronomy. So this is how Bernard and I sort of started together at that stage.
Right.
And
what results came out of
the quite important results. We were looking for these regions of, in those days it was called the slowly varying component,
mm-hmm.
which Arthur Covington had shown was this component associated with sunspots, you see. So I wanted to get a rough idea of how big they were.
Right.
And by the triangulation, we not only got them, but we got a size of 3 minutes of arc.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that was over, I started scratching my head as to how the hell we could build an aerial with a beam width of about 3 minutes of arc.
Well, before you go onto that, another conclusion in this paper was apparently an upper limit to the magnetic field of the sun.
That's right, yes.
Derived from Martin's theory.
Yes, that's right.
Of 8 Gauss. Now, is it?
Well, it was really from a fairly elaborate study of that by Steve Smird, too. We're using, I think, Smird.
What was the status at that time of the knowledge of what the general magnetic field of the sun was?
Very little. Some people said it was there, some said there was none.
Hmm. And when they said it was there, what sort of.
That was roughly, it was thought to be about 4 or 5 Gauss.
I see. And once again, maybe that's not earlier. Okay, go on with what you were saying.
Well, so that then being interested in antennas, you see, I thought, well, heavens, there must be some way of building a highly directional antenna, because there wasn't any at that stage, of course, not one in the world.
Well, yes and no.
Not really a high.
Well, I mean, you had the Michelson interferometer that Roland Vonberg had used.
That's right. Oh, yes, and also.
And you had the Seacliff interferometer.
We had the one that was at the same time as that, of course, the Cliff interferometer.
Right.
But that only gave one component, sort of, at that period. You see, that was only a. It was only a. To get a real.
Didn't give you an image.
It didn't give you an image of any sort, or even a measurement of size, not really. You have to Well, that's you'd be lucky if you did. All it gave was upper limits, really.
Yeah. But of course you could vary the spacing. And
yes, but they didn't.
Yeah, that's true. But now, did you work with the sequence interferometer for a while?
No, not at all. I was right out of that. I'd been just working on about a 18-foot antenna, I think.
Now, when is this that you're beginning to think about?
Now, this must have been after the eclipse, about 1949.
So how did you come to reason?
Well,
it
was very peculiar, actually. I was reading up about the LEO interferometer, yeah. You know, in which you combined one spacing and then another spacing with twice the length and then twice the length, and then mm-hmm. you put that together and you got a thing like that out of it in shape, you know.
Well,
instead of getting a thing like you combined these sine waves, so that instead of with one you would have got something like that. With this combination you got things like that.
You got responses that were very narrow compared to the spacing between
them. And I thought
them.
To myself, oh, yeah. God, that's exactly what I need.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, now what's the analog of that? And I thought, well, it would be a lot of antennas spaced at intervals.
What we call a grating array.
Grating.
You called it that.
No, I didn't at the time. That was called that by Lafineur in France when I went to France. At that time I called it a multiple interferometer.
I see.
And the grating array was a name given to it. In France, they had Musée de la Découverte. They had a model of my Pottsville antenna, and they called it the Christiansen interferometer then, and then under in brackets the grating interferometer.
I see.
So it was the French who really called it grating first.
Well, that's interesting, because I always thought that this was something that was pretty well known in optics, and that you just took it over.
No, it wasn't. It had nothing to do with it. Well, the optics was such a very indirect one, you see. I mean, it was there, but it was a multiple reflection effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's nothing equivalent, really, in optics. There is a whole lot of fat gratings, a whole series of fat holes in an aperture. Multiple slits would be an optical analog, but no one makes that. Or didn't then anyway. Hmm. Not think I do yet.
Well, in any case, that's not how you came upon it.
No, it came from Lewis interferometer.
And so what do you do when you have an idea like this?
Well, I talked to Joe Pawsey, and then I thought, well, I can make it better than the equivalent optical grating, because I can steer it.
Mm-hmm.
I can steer each of the things, so I'll make it have a whole lot of steerable gratings. And I worked at it was trying to get it very cheaply, because we didn't have much money to play around with, and the fact that it was built was really based on the fact that I said I was going to use open wire transmission lines on the thing instead of coax cable, which was very expensive then.
I see.
And everyone sneered and said you couldn't possibly do it at 25 centimeters, but it's never been used in radar, and anyway, it did work. It worked beautifully, and it was so I built this first grating, and
There were no troubles in making the open wire work?
No, it went everything was done very cheaply. We took two standard sheets of aluminium and welded them and spun them into 6-foot things, and we put the simplest type of control on posts. We put a polar axis, and as you ran from one end to the other, you just clicked it, so that you're following the sun, you're just running continuously from one end to the other.
So how long did it take to run from one end to the other?
Oh, well, we took it in turns. What did we do, half an hour to stretch each?
But how long did it take to actually go one set down?
Oh, you could do it, the sun would pass through it, there were 1 degree between the response,
right.
So that there was 4 minutes. You had 4 minutes to do. It wasn't so long. It was only about 800 feet long.
Yeah.
So that you just ran like buggery from one end to the other.
It wasn't quite the 4 minute miles, the 4 minutes, 800 feet.
No, but it was quite fairly strenuous. But it was a nice flat thing. It was on the edge of a... Oh, yes, that was the other thing. I was looking for a nice flat place, and with roughly east-west, and it turned out we had one that was magnetically east-west, along the edge of the Sydney's drinking water along the dam. So they let us put it.
That's the Pottsville, is that?
No,
right?
Pottsville, yes. That's right. Mm. Well, that was working at the Sydney Ursi meeting.
52,
yes,
you mean?
Yes, by 52 we were producing some quite nice pictures. And that was it really went down well at the ERSI meeting. This was something, the first pictures, one-dimensional pictures of the sun, you see, mm-hmm. in radio pictures, so that it caused an enormous amount of interest.
Now, let me ask you...
And at that stage, Martin went to... Because the Japanese weren't allowed to come to Australia, you know, at this stage...
Because of the war.
No, because of after the war, they, you know, Japan and Australia were... Even in 52, it was a pretty sticky sort of situation. You can't imagine it now, but I mean, it was a... So the Japanese decided not to come, I think, because of the situation. So Martin went over there and he told them about my interferometer, and so they wrote to me. I can remember that I've still got the letter because it was such lovely English. I'm not sure it was... this is a little bit sticky because I don't... But better close this off while I do this one.
Well, no, really, this is all in confidence. Anything that I want to quote, I certainly ask for your permission.
No, well, actually, the Japanese sent this letter, and they were saying, you know, how this stinking aerial, I loved that, so I kept the letter, because it's a mixture of stinking and striking, you know. And but anyway, I sent them all the information and all the diagrams and so on, long before I'd published anything. Mm-hmm. And I've always been amused that later on it didn't take more than a few years before it became an independent Japanese invention. And this you even might find that in the literature, because it's been pretty widely peddled, that one. It always annoyed me a bit because, strangely enough, Bowen, who was the head of our place, when I said I'd had this letter from the Japanese, he said... Well, you better be pretty careful because you haven't published anything, and they'll publish before you do.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid he was slightly right. They hadn't published first, of course, took them a long time to. But they made a scale model at about 10 centimetres of our Potts Hill thing. And the Jean-Louis Steinberg, have you mm-hmm. talked
yes,
to him?
Yes.
Well, he came over and he'd been playing around with a four-element one, actually, that he didn't get any luck with. Just four aerials together.
You say he came over to...
He came over to the ERSI meeting, and he was so interested that he said, "My God, I'm going to build one of those." So he went back to... and they built the one at Nancy.
Right.
But it was built in a... It was pretty well to scale, but it was a fixed antennas, because they had... Their antennas were so small in wavelengths that they... With them fixed, they saw the same for quite a long time. Whereas ours kept on. Well, now that... That was quite good, and then the next step...
Let me ask you about the step first. You designed it in order to be able to look at sort of few arc minute structure.
That's right.
But how did the choice of wavelength come about?
Well, it was pure luck, because I had been working at 25 centimetres, and this was 25 again, that's all, because I'd been working. I knew that at 25 centimetres and 50 centimetres, this slowly varying component was very strong. And 25 centimetres was a nice thing in which I had some equipment, and it was really because the equipment was there, I think you could say.
I see.
It was easy to build. It wasn't too big. I could have done it at 10, but then you get into rather nasty electronic stuff, which I preferred to work with in the field where it was fairly conventional, which was up to 25 centimetres.
Well, before we go any further, let me also ask about a couple of papers that you published on this slowly varying component.
Yes, that's right.
Christensen and Heinemann 51 in Nature, in which you talked about verifying von der Holst's theory that there should be a variation with the sunspot cycle.
That's right. Well, that was a sort of a byline. That was just done on our daily observations. You see, we were taking daily observations.
So you were monitoring.
We were monitoring all the time as well as this.
I see. That was with a single...
Single dish. Yes.
And what size?
About 18 feet by 16, I think. It's a square one. I've got a lovely one in my... Look, I must... if you come to Australia, I must see if I can get a copy of that, because I've got one in which we got the did the first map of the on hydrogen line.
Oh, yes.
We used the same aerial, and it's one with all the stars around the
Oh, yes, I'd love to see that.
Yes. Actually, it was published by Life.
Oh, okay. Well, I can look it up there.
Yeah, you'll find it. There was a what was his name? He was a German photographer.
The photographer.
Extremely good photographer. He came out to Australia.
So that would be life in 52, probably?
Yes, probably. 54, it might have been. 53 in that region, 52, 54. Mm-hmm. It was whenever it was that I was doing those, doing the work on the hydrogen line.
Was it a whole article on this, or just a single?
I think he did a whole article, yeah. Yes, in Australian Radio Astronomy, that's right.
Okay, I'll check that out. But what was the result of these several years of monitoring, would you say?
Well, the monitoring result, we